die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Name God, and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
To the unknown future. This is Red Ice Radio. For the Seeker.
Reason and knowing are quite different.
I must strive to know.
Welcome back, folks. It's always rewarding to have you with us wherever you are around the world as we continue our inquiry into all the topics that we find interesting, important, and sometimes controversial. My name is Henrik, and we invite guests not always to represent our own views, but to discuss theirs in an effort to highlight contradictory and challenging information so that we may both test and sharpen our own beliefs. The two most recent programs we've done was at least peripherally on the topic of historical review. So we are going to continue in this tradition today as we talk with Lynn Picknett about her revised version of the story of Lucifer. Lynn is a writer, researcher, and lecturer on the paranormal, the occult, and historical and religious mysteries. Lynn, together with Clive Prince, has authored The Templar Revelation, Secret Guardians of the True Identity of Christ, that was inspired by the New York Times bestseller The Da Vinci Code and The Secret Supper. Today we'll discuss her book The Secret History of Lucifer, the sequel to Mary Magdalene, Christianity's Hidden Goddess. We'll discuss what the spirit of Lucifer represents and what principles it has brought to the world. Lynn talks about the murky areas between good and evil and the symbiotic relationship between Christianity and Satanism, as well as the myth of Yahweh. Picknett explains the female aspects of Lucifer, or the Lightbringer, the name and the association with stars and planets. She also talks about monotheism and the ruthless undermining of the feminine and medieval churchmen who were fanatically determined to root out what they perceived as female evil in the witch hunt hysteria era. Okay, let's get to it and we'll see what you think. All right, well, welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Lynn. Good to talk to you again. Hope everything is good over in the UK.
Oh, thank you for having me back. It's my pleasure.
You bet.
Things are a bit cold and snowy and rainy and blowy over here, but it's winter, so what can one expect?
It is. What is it? Almost February after all. So that's where we are
exactly.
At this point. all right, Lynn. We have the topic of Lucifer on the agenda today, and an interesting one, the one that keeps coming up in different contexts and different versions of the story. Obviously, today we want to get your take on it. We want to look at this from the point of view of your book, The Secret History of Lucifer. Why don't we just talk about the background in terms of your interest in Lucifer, when this weaved into your research, or if it was just kind of a side note. How did that happen?
Well, it was quite complicated and a slow process, really, I suppose. I mean, I didn't start off in my writing career thinking I must write a book about Lucifer. The book that I wrote before that was Mary Magdalene, Christianity's Hidden Goddess. And I was absolutely fascinated by how her church, her secret organization, they called her Mary Lucifera, and got themselves in an awful lot of trouble in medieval times for that. But in fact, it just meant Mary the Lightbringer. But then it became, the thoughtless Inquisition, literally mindless. They just thought, oh, well, Lucifer, obviously bad. let's burn them. So I was just intrigued by what we take to be demonic. You know, just a word here or a word there. What we take perhaps to sound demonic, but actually turns out to be something beautiful. And then I started researching ideas about Lucifer. That's Lucifer as opposed to Satan. I mean, there is a difference. Most people think there isn't, but there is a difference. Lucifer, the son of the morning, the light bringer, and Satan, the embodiment of evil. And I think only really warped and dangerous and very sick people actually would want to follow the path of Satan. But Lucifer is something else entirely. I began to feel very drawn to the idea of a Lucifer who is a questioner and a challenger. In other words, the spirit of progress, really, the spirit of scientific progress, which is actually quite ironic, considering that Clive Prince and I's last joint book, which was The Forbidden Universe, which was in some respect not anti-science, absolutely not, but questioning the likes of Richard Dawkins' position. But anyway, that's slightly ironic.
Well, that's an interesting connection, though, Lynn, actually. The follow-through on science, is that something that has, today it represents something very different than when the scientific field started back in, you know, with alchemists and, you know, more of a kind of an occult nature to it, if you will. Today it's very, very different. Is it, in your view, something that is, quote-unquote, can we call it evil in a certain extent, science as it is today?
I think, to be fair, only if it's actually used for evil and deliberately used for evil, you know. But no, I certainly would not call science evil, but I think that it's often, because it's divorced from its occult roots, and there's no doubt that its roots were occult, science has lost its heart, if you like. It's mechanistic still. It shouldn't be now in the quantum era, but it's very mechanistic, and an awful lot of scientists refuse to think, even consider anything of the spirit, which I think is completely wrong, because it's completely overlooking its own research, because science has discovered over the last few years that people are actually hardwired to worship. You know, that's the phrase. We are hardwired to worship, to believe in something outside of ourselves. So they prove that on the one hand, and on the other hand, they pour scorn, not all of them, but a good many of them, pour scorn on people who do believe. And, you know, and you think, well, wait a minute, this is part of being human. So therefore, there must be, that in itself must be a perfect and just and valid path to research. You know, we all have this thing hardwired into us, so go ahead, research it, and don't just pour scorn on it. I mean, some researchers do that. Some scientists do that. They are open-minded. They are true scientists. You know, a true scientist is open-minded by very nature. But I see Lucifer. I mean, and I would say, because some people will get this wrong, unless I do, that I don't believe in a being called Lucifer. I don't believe there is a being called Lucifer. I believe that, I'm using the term, if you like, poetically or metaphorically, you know, it's an embodiment in my mind, you know, of a principle. And the principle is the very human principle of pushing and pushing knowledge and pushing daring. And, you know, even just like the Olympics, which, of course, we've had in London last year, you know, just to see what people can achieve that just 100 years ago was thought of as being impossible. No, and that is the Luciferian spirit, and there's nothing evil about it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting conversation. Yeah, if we then go back as far as we can, or as far as you have in the book, tell us about where the concept comes from. Is it, there must be some kind of deity worship at the start of it, correct? What do you think?
Well, yes, it actually didn't really come from one source. Lucifer is mentioned in the Old Testament as a being of immense pride who was cast out of heaven. But even that is somewhat murky, because, you know, you think, oh, well, that's the story, that's what it was. But actually, there is quite a lot of evidence that the writer was actually referring to the king of Babylon. And he's infamous arrogance. So even there, you know, he's not necessarily talking about, some kind of supernatural being.
Right.
And there's all sorts of other elements from other ancient religions. There's Shatan, obviously it sounds like Satan, from the Sidonian religion. But ancient Egypt, of course, has quite an input to the idea. There's Set. Now this is where it gets controversial, but I think there's no two ways about this. Set was their idea of evil. He was kind of the bad god in their pantheon of many gods. But to them, every god had its purpose. They wouldn't condemn him, and he wasn't totally evil. But he was the god of the desert, and to people who had to basically live on narrow strips of land on either side of the Nile, and therefore, because that was the only place that was fertile. That was the only place where, you could grow crops and you could live your life under palm trees. But the rest of it was desert. And to them, the desert was hell. You know, they knew what it was like to be out there in dust storms. They knew what it was like to be out there without water. If anybody did, they did. And to them, the desert was hell. And the god of the desert was Set. Now, as I said, this is where it gets controversial, because although some elements, like his very name is a bit sort of satanic, Set, so you can imagine it might be taken into Satan, mm-hmm. and some people suggest it was, but there is more evidence that he was a prototype for the God of the Old Testament, in other words, Jehovah.
Yeah.
Because Jehovah, after all, was the god of the desert. He came to all the prophets in the desert. He led Moses into the desert and kept them lost for 40 years, in the desert. So there's a very murky area there. What is evil? What is good? And, everybody accusing everybody else's gods of being evil as well. That's what people do. That's the way people are, sadly, one of the... Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I just wanted to say that, obviously a big part of this is when monotheism comes into the picture. If we have a quote-unquote, pagan world before this or belief system, you had a pantheon, as you said, different gods for different type of properties being expressed in nature, different type of archetypal forces, if you will. But all of a sudden, this idea of there can only be one kind of thing comes into the picture. And that's when I would presume then that a lot of these so-called problems arise. What do you think, Lynn?
Yes, I would agree. I mean, I personally think that, monotheism has an awful lot of evils to answer for over the years. Monotheism and male monotheism. And strangely enough, an awful lot of people might think I'm, card-carrying feminist. Compared to some people, I definitely am. But, In the days of feminism in the 70s, I wasn't. I wasn't part of that movement. But now I dislike injustices wherever they happen to fall. To women, to men, to children, whatever. The idea that the great monotheistic religions we still have with us, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and they don't have goddesses anymore. They did, all of them, unbelievably. Christianity had Mary Magdalene, which we know from the forbidden gospels, the Gnostic gospels, that disappeared, that were hidden because they were being persecuted when the Bible was officially put together by vote. The New Testament was put together by vote in the 4th century. And all of the gospels, and there were many, many gospels who just didn't fit the bill. That basically had ideas in them that were horrifying to the men of the Council of Nicaea, the Vatican's Council of Nicaea. Mm. And one of the ideas that they really couldn't allow people to read about was that Mary Magdalene was the star of the Christian movement, apart from Jesus. She was like the power behind the throne. All of these Gospels, what they have in common, these forbidden ones that were lost and then found again, and have been translated, what they have in common is that Mary Magdalene is the star. She's fantastic. And a bit too in your face, a bit too feisty perhaps, but she was hated by Jesus' male disciples. So that's Christianity's goddess was Mary Magdalene, no two ways about it. And even Jehovah, you know, in the old days, had a consort, had a wife, if you like, called Asherah. And in fact, its inscriptions have been found on very ancient bits of pottery and bits of altar in the Middle East to basically to Yahweh and his consort Asherah. But then she fell by the wayside. I mean, basically, the story is always the same. You know, you have a balanced religion, and then one or the other, you know, the male or the female, gets tipped, it's usually the male, becomes dominant. And the female is literally demonized. You know, Asherah became a demon in the eyes of the church. She became even, she changed sex even. She became the demon Asmodeus. But basically, she was Jehovah's wife. So then you have, as you say, monotheism takes over, and you have basically one set of attributes. You know, you have the smiting, jealous, petty-minded God of the Old Testament, with no leeway to be, I mean, to be particularly merciful, to be warm, to be anything other than unpredictable. And that is going to affect people's psyche. You know, it's actually going to produce very strange, I mean, you know, fanatical religious people are going to become like their God, basically.
Well, yeah, this is kind of an interesting thing. You theorize a little bit about if this is forces that we are collectively creating, I guess we could say, because so many people are focusing on them, right? We're creating
absolutely.
These energies, yeah?
Yes. Yes, you know, and there's an old saying. I don't know whether it's true of America, but there's an old saying over here that "Speak of the devil, and he will appear." Not that I'm actually suggesting this is literally true, but I think that, you know, people who see the devil's hand in you know, everything, not everything, but most things, all day. You know, oh, the devil made me do that. The devil made her do that. The devil speaking through him, you know, that kind of thing. They are creating a kind of evil. You know, they are literally demonizing other people and indeed part of their own psyche. They're creating evil, you know, by believing in the devil. And I you know, it's something that I feel very strongly about. I'm actually part of an ex-Mormon Facebook page, because indeed I used to be a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting that there's some people on there who are actually not ex, they're still members of the faith, practicing members of the faith, and they do have a tendency to say the devil spoke through so-and-so, and it just makes me go cold. It just absolutely makes me go cold. I think, you, because anybody can say that about what you're doing when you do that, you're pointing to a person or a group of people and you're saying the devil speaks through them. In other words, they're less than human. They're demonic.
Mm.
So that would justify any kind of appalling action on your part towards them. And history is replete with actions like that. You know, like the Nazis basically said that the Jews weren't human or the Gypsies weren't human. So it's okay to do these appalling things to them. It's our duty to do these appalling things to them.
Do you think that it's trying to rather describe a principle within mankind collectively that we all have within us? I mean, we know about the good and quote-unquote evil forces within us, but is that really what it's trying to describe? But this has now been taken to an extreme then by some people, as you say.
Well, yes. I mean, everybody is a huge number of attributes. I mean, everybody is a sort of a mix of people, if you like. We're all different people inside. And some people, as we know, some, you know, it's sort of abnormal psychology, admittedly, but, you know, the idea of people with all sorts of different personalities coming through, you know, which are very interesting and quite scary. I've actually witnessed that myself in somebody, and that's somebody close to me, and it was very scary. You know, a completely different personality starts speaking.
Hmm.
But that's, as I said, they're sort of on the, if you like, abnormal psychology end of things. On the normal everyday end of things, even so, we're all different people. We know how our moods can make us change. You know, we can snap at somebody because we don't feel well, or we can sneer at somebody else because you know, we've got a headache coming on, you know, or somebody says something nasty to us and we take it out on somebody else. Or it can be, go the opposite way. We, you know, we're feeling good for whatever reason. We smile at somebody, we praise somebody, you know. But these things do have a tendency to gather, you know, to roll on, and to sort of roll out across all our contacts daily. And therefore, I think religion is useful in some respects. It's not the only way of dealing with this, but it's useful in general. It encourages us to be wary of our behavior, of the way we express ourselves, the way we conduct ourselves towards other people. And, you know, that can't be a bad thing. It depends, of course, exactly how it encourages us to behave. I think, you know, that because we are all of these people, because we do have evil inside of us, and there's no doubt about that, you know, it's, we have to watch it. I mean, I was actually talking to somebody today about, I was saying, you know, about the necessity to have laws. And I was saying, well, yes, because frankly, you know, if there were no laws, and, you know, we could have, well guns in this country, which we can't in the UK. I was saying, you know, frankly, you know, some idiot walking down the road playing music very loudly, or, you know, riding down the road with his, that, you know, with his car windows open, playing music incredibly loudly, they would be dead. Because my instant reaction is one of fury. But, you know, but because we live in a civilized world, you know, and we actually can't, we just don't, on the whole, you know, rise to that. We don't react in the way that instinctively we would. Because we have culture, we have a civilization, and it might be, you know, very, very thinly layered on us, and thinner sometimes than others, but that's what we have. We have, you know, but, and we've been brought up in a certain way to, you know, to behave, to interact with each other with a degree of a degree of tolerance. Also, of course, I suppose I'm just thinking about, you know, not even shouting at the guy causing mayhem with his music. It actually is not just tolerance; it's fear, of course. You know, you don't know what he'd do back. But these things, you know, it is all about interaction. It is all about. It's almost like weighing up your reaction with other people, instinctively and unconsciously, all the time. And you don't obviously say unconsciously, because you don't sit down and think, oh, well, I'm going to be saying this and that, and is that bad? You might if you're some kind of fundamentalist, but you know, it's actually, it's sort of inborn in you to some extent how to behave, because we're all part of the same species, you know, we're all part of the same human gang.
Sure, sure. Now, let me bring it back a little bit, and let's talk a little bit more about the name, obviously, and how this became associated with the principle. We're talking about Venus, a planet, the morning star is another name, the light bringer. Also, this idea that the character is fallen, has fallen from the stars, if you will. What does this come from? This is astrological terms, if you will.
The thing is that the Roman goddess of love and beauty, Venus. She was the evening star. She was the beautiful evening star, and she became associated also with the morning star, because the morning star was beautiful, woke us up. And, you know, basically the idea that the morning star was seen with the sun. So there was the idea of the earth being energized and literally enlightened. And the morning star was associated with Lucifer. So the two became entangled in minds. The evening star, Venus, and Lucifer, the morning star. And the idea that also of Venus, she was called Venus Lucifera, Venus the light bringer. And in both senses, in the sense of being the enlightener, bringing light to the world, but also the enlightener through her mysteries, which involved some kind of, you know, sexual mysteries or mysteries of love, mysteries of female power. Through those, she was also the enlightener. She was the initiatrix, if you like. So the two ideas of Lucifer, which is kind of the male energy, enlightening the world first thing in the morning, and Venus taking us into the night, and also in a sort of tangled way, but the ancients did think of the two together in the morning. So you had the male and the female principles enlightening and empowering the world first thing in the morning, and Lucifer being one, and Venus Lucifera being the other.
And what about the that Jesus is called the morning star as well? What's that association has to do with this?
Yes, there's various, I mean, the Gnostics, that's a strand of Christianity that's not the main strand. In fact, it's almost gone from the earth now. But basically, the Gnostics were a loose, several groups of people, hundreds of Christians with actually sometimes wildly different beliefs. But they did believe that Jesus was Lucifer, but also, again, in the sense of being the light bringer, the ultimate light bringer, if you like. I mean, they didn't think that he was Satan, because, you know, that there is the moment when he stands and he looks over, looks over the world, and he's tempted by Satan. Get me behind me, Satan, you know. Obviously not that, but he was assumed to be, again, it's this idea of light bringer. Lucifer, the most brilliant being you could possibly imagine. You know, the great powerful being empowering you through belief, through faith, and through wisdom.
We hear that Lucifer has a kind of a consort, if you will, of other angels with him, her. Then in this case, how did they fit into this picture? And is that just a story of a reference to the stars, of some kind of cataclysmic event, or is it a real rebellion of certain angels against God? What do you make of it?
Well, I'm not sure that I believe any stories whatsoever that one finds in the Bible. I mean, do I believe in angels? I'm not sure. I don't think I do. I certainly don't believe in the story of, you know, the rebellion in heaven. So, no, I wouldn't say I personally would not say that is a literally true story. No, mm-hmm. not at all. Mm-hmm. There are lots of reasons for believing in things that fall to earth. You know, people have seen, you know, meteorites for thousands of years, although nobody knew really what they were. But they were just amazing things, you know. And even occasionally in the UK, with all its cloud cover and things, you can, once a year, you know, you can see meteorites in the distance. Not meteorites, sorry, you can see, you know, falling stars. As they're called. And it's a very beautiful and quite scary thing. And I think the ancient people had to build them into their myths, build them into the way they think about the world, which was kind of holistic. You know, it wasn't just, it wasn't a cosmological or astronomical event. You know, they didn't think like that. It was magical. It was all part of the earth and its energy and our interaction with it. So I think that's, you know, they had to deal with things falling to earth and put it in the context of their poetic and religious history. And, you know, these are beautiful things. They're beautiful things if you see them from a distance, not if they fall on your head, obviously. But they're also quite scary things. So, yeah, I can see why they would think that they were the sort of cohorts of Lucifer. But I don't think there's any foundation whatsoever to the story. No.
Where do you go to I guess dig out some of the texts about Lucifer? You mentioned some of the Gnostic texts and stuff like that. Is there other sources you go to find more information about this?
Well, it's such a vast. I mean, the problem with the subject of Satan, stroke Lucifer, any of these things, is it's a vast subject that's been covered over the years by some extraordinary researchers. And to be absolutely honest, I didn't go much further than the British Library. Mind you, that is further than a lot of people go. I mean, I didn't sit, you know, and look things up on the internet. I went to the library and I went through a great many books on the subject. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't read Hebrew, you know. So I couldn't go down that route of reading very ancient texts. But I would suggest that what one does read the Gnostic Gospels, which are now well, I think they're all, the ones we have anyway, obviously, I think they're all in translation in English. So, and I'm quite familiar with those. I mean, again, you see, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not saying that every single thing in the Gnostic Gospels is, you know, just brilliant and worth
sure.
knowing. And
sure.
because they do go on a bit about, I mean, it's quite funny sometimes. They go on for pages about, they love inventing sort of circles of hell. You know, there's 29 circles of hell with 31, you know, subdivisions, and you go around there and up there if you committed this particular sort of sin, and you know, and they just love all that, and you get very, very bored, and you know, you stop sort of grinning after a while. You think, oh no, shut up. But they are very, very good when they start talking about Jesus and the other people on his mission, because quite clearly they're from, well, they all seem to draw on the same source, which is interesting. And they haven't made it up, as various people, you know, Christian traditionalists who don't like the idea of Gnostic Gospels say, oh, you know, they made it all up. No, because when they talk about them, it's not all sweetness and light among the disciples at all. It describes huge rows between them. And it's always the same people who are, you know, having a go at the same people. It's always Peter who's having a go at Mary Magdalene and the women. It's really quite unpleasant and ugly. So it's hardly likely that they made it up, because they were trying to get converts, you know. But in there, you know, there are ideas about evil. There are ideas about good, which would seem very strange to an awful lot of people brought up in traditional, for example, traditional Christian beliefs, because the Gnostics in general, I mean, some of them didn't believe this, but in general, they looked around and they saw this world as being, you know, deeply unpleasant, very dangerous, you know, appalling. Everyday life was a terrible struggle. And they thought, well, this can't be a good God that rules this world. This world must be ruled by, some horrible God masquerading as the good God. So this was the demiurge, the partial mover. And they believed that over and above the demiurge was the prime mover, was the good God. But the good God was kind of unknowable to human beings, and that was while we are, you know, in our fleshly bodies, and so the Gnostics in general really hated physicality. They hated being in bodies. To them, everything physical and material was evil, and anything they could do to escape this, to get onto a purely spiritual plane, they would do. And to get to pure goodness, to get to know the real God, that was the way to do it. But basically, to them, the God of the Old Testament was evil. And I don't think they did know necessarily about, you know, I was saying earlier about the Egyptian god Set, the god of the desert, being equated with Yahweh of the Old Testament. But to the Gnostics, that seemed to work out that, in fact, to them, Yahweh was evil.
Yeah, see, this is what's interesting to me, again, depending on what texts you read, depending on what interpretation of this you read, but there is a very, very tight relationship here between God and Satan. It's you know, one is black, one is white, but sometimes you don't know who is who. It's like it's interchanging. Yeah. There's a mirroring going on here.
Yes, and they need each other as well.
Right.
It's a symbiotic relationship. It's quite interesting to me that out-and-out Satanists, of which there are relatively few, you know, but they actually are a form of Christian, because to them they are rebelling often in a very, well, mostly in a very childish fashion against their Christian upbringing. You know, they couldn't be Satanists without a basic belief in God, you know. Who are they rebelling against,
yeah.
you know? And in a way, you know, believers in God need to believe in the devil as a sort of balance, and also, you know, to explain things like temptation and evil. Otherwise, they'd be Gnostics, you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'd just say that this world is so appalling. It's beautiful in some respects, but, you know, everyday life is still very much a struggle, and it's worse for some people, you know. So, you know, how can a good God rule this earth? So, yeah, I mean, the ideas of God and the ideas of the devil, they do need each other, particularly the God that of the West. I mean, obviously, there are other religious systems that are... the attitude is different, but I mean, basically Buddhism, for example, doesn't have any gods at all, which is quite an interesting one. But yes, I mean, you know, it's quite interesting, the study of Satanism, how childish it is and how very, very Christian it is, basically.
Well, it's an interesting point. I've pondered upon that too, is that the rebellion against it is within the confines of how the Christian religion is defined, if you will. And therefore, yes, as a follow-on to that question, we hear about Satanists in the world, and then some people, as you've clarified here now, associate that also with Luciferianism. We can, of course, make a distinction between these if you'd like, but I wanted to ask you this. If there are some people that, equate the elite, the political elite, the royal elite, what have you out there, mm-hmm. that being... They're Satanists. They're Luciferians. What do you make of that?
Well, I think any kind of sweeping statement like that has to be suspect. It's an enormous sweeping statement, isn't it? To say, the ruling elite. I mean, I have a problem with people who say, oh look, there's these rich men who club together to rule the world. Well, of course they do. I mean, it's not even that sinister. That's what they've always done, you know. Why shouldn't... I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not condoning any kind of plot against, you know, ordinary people. Because I don't necessarily believe there are plots as such. But what my point is that, you know, throughout history, you've always had the ruling elite, for good or ill. And they've always looked after each other's interests because... they're the ruling elite and they want to stay that way. So, now you have various groups of people, but if you look at America, there's always the same families backing whatever, whoever's in power.
Sure.
And in Britain it's similar, you know. The royal family, I know quite a bit about them because I've written books about them, but I wouldn't say they're up to anything sinister. They're just trying to maintain their own interests. Now, whether you agree with their interests or not is an entirely other matter, but I don't think there's anything sinister going on. I think they're just doing what they've always done.
Do you think that they have a theological belief that binds them? I mean, and again, we can look at this from different point of view. Some people have pointed out that, you know, when George W. Bush came onto the scene, he was kind of like posing as a Christian, you know, but he behind the scenes were not really that. But do you think that they have something, a theological interest that bind the people who rule the earth?
I don't think people do rule the earth. I mean, I think that, you know, it's I know I just don't think people do rule the earth. I think that every country, every political system has, you know, the guys who want to be top dog all the time. And that's why we have, you know, elections and, you know, so all sorts of strings are pulled, but then that's humanity for you. I don't think there's a theology. I don't think you can say that a huge bunch of people have a theology. I'm just thinking randomly here. I mean, the Queen, for example, I think is no more, no less than a rather old-fashioned Christian. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what she is. And I think her son, Prince Charles, I think he's a bit more New Age than that. he's more inclusive in his ideas about faith, you know. But, I mean, I don't think any group of people rule the earth. Maybe some people would like to, but I don't think they do. I think... I just don't see any evidence from it.
Okay, all right. Now, earlier you said that the principle that we're talking about here then kind of represents industry, science, progress, someone who pushes the boundaries, if you will. Is this why you think that the principle has been associated as a rebellion against God, kind of a rebellion against the rules, if you will, and maybe, even maybe we can tie in nature into that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, especially in a time when, for example, you know, throughout most of the last 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has basically, if you talk about an organization that, quotes, ruled the world, that, you know, it was the Catholic Church in the last 2,000 years in Europe. And during that time, very largely, you know, anybody who stepped outside the rules was a heretic and therefore evil. Something like Leonardo da Vinci, for example, you know, who basically broke the rules time and time again, simply because of a thirst for knowledge, a contempt. I mean, he was unbelievably bright. I mean, even, you know, by today's standards, he's just phenomenally bright and therefore inquisitive and therefore absolutely eaten up with a curiosity about the world. And basically the Catholic Church did not encourage that. You know, any idea that people would go and learn something that they hadn't taught was terrifying to them. It's very dangerous. And they were quite right, actually, because the more people step outside, you know, the rules laid down by an organization like that, the more they're likely to take other people with them to question and to challenge. And that is Luciferian.
See, what's interesting to me then, if you look at it from that point of view and look at the actions of the Vatican, according to how they behave and all that, it's almost like you could turn the mirror on them and say, well, aren't they behaving in a quote-unquote satanistic way, right?
Well, I mean, I would say that one of the most evil organizations the world has ever seen was the Inquisition, which still exists, by the way. It's called something else now.
Yeah.
I mean, it tortured and killed hundreds upon thousands of people over the centuries, usually for no real reason apart from a kind of terror and fear. And they're mainly women, which is a fact. It's not some kind of weird feminist stance of mine. It's a fact. They were mainly women. And in fact, the Inquisition was set up in the 13th century specifically to deal with heretic women of the south of France. And then it rapidly changed, you know, officially anyway, include everybody, all heretics, you know.
Why was that, Lynn, if we kind of go a little deeper in that? Why did they start to persecute certain women then?
Well, it was mainly it was the Cathars in southern France who were a sect who believed that they were going back to true Christianity as it was in the Bible, which, you know, they believed it was a very simple, primitive thing which didn't have priests, it didn't have a Vatican, you know, it didn't have this imposition from above on everything you did every day. Basically, they were semi-vegetarian. They had women preachers. Now that was the thing, you know. Basically, spiritually, the women were seen to be equal to the men, and that was the thing that the Vatican could not allow, could not stand. And the women themselves, I mean, the Cathars themselves were quite open about where they got this from. They claimed to have got this from Mary Magdalene's legacy, and that Mary Magdalene had been a preacher, and she had basically been Jesus's, not wife, notice, but his lover and his priestess. And they believed this, and the women and the men in the Cathar movement went around together preaching and baptizing, and the Catholic Church just saw this. Well, they were terrified by it, basically. They saw this as not only a great challenge to them, you know, the idea that this heresy had taken hold of the whole of the south of France and was spreading into Italy, you know, is threatening their dominion and their domination of Europe. But also it was the female angle that they could not allow. Because in choosing the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John for the New Testament, as I said earlier, they had very, very cleverly rejected all the Gospels that went on about Mary Magdalene being a very powerful woman in Jesus' movement. And so here, they thought she'd come back to haunt them through the Cathars. So basically, they went and they set up the Inquisition to deal with them. They called them witches. That was the beginning of what became the witch hunt that went on for centuries in Europe, and then spread to America, of course, with the Salem thing.
Right.
Although that wasn't the Inquisition, but that was a kind of hysteria. That was a similar sort of hysteria. So that was, so yes, I would agree that if we're looking at the Inquisition, that's certainly an evil empire. No two ways about it.
Now, and some people have also talked about or speculated that this is also at the same time a destruction of various disciplines, if you will, knowledge of, for example, medicinal plants, herbs, things that they were actually going after at that point, because they, it seems to me, as I analyze that period of the quote-unquote dark ages, if you will, that that's almost like a reset, a reboot of civilization. All things that are tied to the ancient world are kind of destroyed at that point, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. When the witch hunts got going, I mean, they were sort of completely mindless, and people would, women mainly again, were picked out by neighbours who'd had rows with them and said, she's a witch, and then they, under torture, they would name other people and the whole villages would disappear. But one of the main categories of people who were accused of witchcraft by the Inquisition were midwives. Because what did midwives do? In theory anyway, if they could, they helped ease the pains of childbirth. And to the Inquisition, to the Vatican, this was appallingly evil, because didn't God himself intend women to suffer terribly in childbirth? So midwives were deemed to be evil, and there were very special, hideous tortures reserved for midwives. And also for herbalists, who were again often local old women in the village who would, give you a potion to drink that would help your toothache or something like that. And most of the time people were glad of it. But if there was a witch finder in town, and he might give you a few shillings for your trouble, naming a witch, they would be the first to go. And they would be, they'd boil something up in a pan that smells horrible. Obviously, it's some kind of demonic thing, So the people who dealt in natural cures were often seen to be satanic, as indeed sometimes they still are in some places, a good point there. I totally agree. It's anybody who's trying to help somebody else but do it through natural means, like picking herbs at certain phases of the moon, for example, that is still seen in some circles as being, tainted with sort of Satanism.
Now, exactly. Is this, there is a kind of a revising going on, the Wiccan religion or whatever it actually is kind of coming back. There's a lot of people in England interested in Druidism and things like that.
Yes.
Is that a part of that coming back, do you think?
I think there will always be people who want a nature-based religion. And there will also be triggers in certain parts of history, that make people turn towards these religions. And if they aren't there, they'll invent them. That after the Second World War, the rise of materialism, that's what actually, I think, culminated in the 1970s occult explosion. Wicca getting such a grounding in the States and the pagan churches and so on growing. And that was, I think, based in the 1950s, emphasis on materialism, I think there is a great going back, yes, because, in the world of, iPods and Mars missions and things like that, I think people want to feel the earth under their feet. They want to feel that, I was talking about the hard wiring that science has located in us, the hard wiring to worship. I think we want to be allowed to express that without being told how to do it.
Sure. And then, as you said, that interesting kind of dichotomy against that then is that we have a principle like Lucifer that is also representative of the of that progress, right? Science, industry,
yes.
pushing forward.
Yes.
So
yes.
is there a balance at play here to a certain extent? I don't know.
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, you know, I've come to the conclusion after all my years on Earth that life is a paradox. Or rather, it's not so much a paradox, it's a kind of double helix. It's just like I have this idea in my head of sort of the ideas of good and evil being like a double helix, kind of, you know, like a caduceus, sort of swirling round like a DNA spiral. You know, it's like God and Satan needing each other as concepts, you know. I think the Luciferian thing is rebelling against the outmoded, the worn out. It's both a rebellion against materialism and a rebellion against scientism. It's rebellion. It's rebellion, but not rebellion for its own sake. It's rebellion when you come to the tipping point of your psyche where you absolutely have to go down the path that is right for you with all the energy, the Luciferian energy behind you. That's when you go. And it almost doesn't matter what you're rebelling against. It's the energy that you're gathering in your psyche that actually allows you to produce something great. Something creative, whether it's just in your life or you know, interacting with other people. You know, because there's room for everybody. I firmly believe there's room for everybody at their own tipping points. I think we all have something to give like this, and it's only when we have all the energy, if you like, from Lucifer behind us, that we can actually do it.
Do you think, Lynn, that Lucifer overall should be revised, if you will, in history?
Well, I do, because, you know, for a start, as I said earlier, you know, I don't believe that Lucifer's an entity. I believe he or she or it represents all the dynamism of humanity. It's not evil at all. So that's the revision, yes.
Yeah, but should there be a quote-unquote religion set up around it?
Well, I'm inclined to say no, because then a religion, I think, a Luciferian religion would be, I think, full of very cranky people all doing their own thing, so it wouldn't really be a religion in the end. I think it'd be a very, very loose organization of individuals, which I don't think would last very long, like most organizations when you think about it. But it's an interesting concept, but no, because everybody has their own idea of Lucifer, I think. That in the south of France they called him her or Lucibel, which is rather a nice name, I think. And, you know, as this sort of androgynous, shining being. And I think that's quite good. If you want something to imagine in your head and kind of worship, Lucibel is quite a good idea. But be careful what you allow him, her or it to stand for, really.
Now, there is an undercurrent, as there always is in history. If we look at the Theosophical Society, for example, they've venerated this deity, if we can call it then, for some time. They even had a magazine called Lucifer at a certain point as well. How do you think that have they, in your opinion, done a good job then at preserving this or representing what this means or stands for?
Well, I think they have to some extent, but I mean, you know, my take on Lucifer is pretty much my take on Lucifer, piecing together, you know, certain texts of what I've read. But the Theosophical Society, founded by Madame Blavatsky, I love what she wrote about Lucifer. I mean, I absolutely love it. I think people should read what she wrote. She was very funny. She, you know, didn't suffer fools gladly, so she's very direct. And basically, she says what I've said about, you know, I came to it sort of reading her, but also reading other stuff and, you know, coming to my own conclusions. But basically, you know, she said it's foolishness to think of Lucifer as evil, and she gives reasons. So I would, I think she certainly did a very good job of, educating people about the real Lucifer. And I think Lucifer is a brilliant name for a magazine. You know, the Lightbringer, superb. Why not?
We have a few minutes here before we wrap things up for this time. We have an hour with you this time, Lynn. And why don't we just briefly talk about some of the newer works that you have? You mentioned it before on science specifically. Talk a little bit about the new work.
Yes, it's a book that came out a year or so back now, co-authored with Clive Prince, called The Forbidden Universe, subtitled The Occult Origins of Science and the Search for the Mind of God. The first half is about how science began, basically, with alchemists, with people behind closed doors working secretly with test tubes and so on. And then with the coming of the Enlightenment in the latter part of the 17th century and onwards towards the Industrial Revolution, you have an explosion of rationalism in which science went one way and, if you like, religion and mysticism went the other. But in the second part of the book, we're talking about how the cutting edge of quantum physics actually is, if you like, is bringing the mysticism back into science, but not actually necessarily recognized as such. And in fact, the old way of looking at the universe, which we discuss through the Hermetic texts, based on old ancient Egyptian works, that actually fueled the imagination of every single big name in the scientific revolution, from Copernicus through to Newton. The Hermetic texts were their great big inspiration. So we look at them and we think, wait a minute, even these ancient texts, they're talking in terms that fit precisely with the new quantum physics. And so that's very remarkable and very exciting.
Indeed. Now, tell our listeners where they can go, of course, to read more about the books and pick up copies of them.
Well, I would say Amazon, basically. I don't know how the library system works in America, but I'm sure you can order them through the library. I shouldn't be saying that. We want you to spend money on us, don't we? But, you know, it'd be good just to have you read them. And we've got a Wikipedia page and, you know, the internet. We'll find us on the internet.
Indeed. Do you have the URL for your website, Lynn?
Yes, it is www.picknetprince.com, and that's all one word. It's PicknetPrince.com. Now, we are experiencing a few problems with our website at the moment, but do persist, and anyway, you'll get the gist of what we're about.
All right, there we go, picknetprince.com. We'll have this linked up as well, of course. All right, we'll wrap things up for this time. Thanks for your time, Lynn. Really appreciate it, hearing more about your perspective and about Lucifer. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much for having me on. Much appreciated.
Okay, that's our program for today. We could only have Lynn with us for an hour, but we'll be back with much more shortly. Tom Horn on the abdication of the Pope and Vatican ET disclosure is up next. Interesting stuff. We have Richard Hoagland, Josh Reeves, Suzanne Posel, Dan Johnson, and many more lined up after this. Check out redicecreations.com for much more radio, news, and everything else. Have a great rest of your day, and we will talk to you soon.